Yeah, it's a great pleasure for me to give this talk to you. Of course, all of you who are my colleagues in particle physics can in principle go home. You just have to stay for politeness. I will not say much that you haven't heard, and if I do, then you probably won't agree. And those of you who went to the SNOMAS meeting can sort of also go home, because this is in some sense also a mini review with some personal opinions, of course, on what was said last week. This is actually not the outline of my talk. I will not touch on all these points. This is what I thought are sort of the main topics of our program. We have a 13-week program here on LHC physics, and of course it is very broad. People from different communities spend time here, and I wanted to just comment a little bit on sort of the breadth of this program as we go along. But my talk is really about the Higgs discovery, officially July 4th of last year, which really was a monumental event in particle physics. I think one cannot overstate the importance of this discovery for our field, because in some sense what was discovered there was a new type of particle. It's true that many people say, well, the Higgs was expected, its mass was more or less predicted, so what's the big surprise? But we really discovered a new type of particle. You all know this picture, which on slides, of course, looks much nicer than I can draw it here. In the standard model, roughly speaking, we have the matter fields, the quarks and leptons, they're fermions, they are the constituents of matter. We have the gauge bosons, photon, gluon, W, and C, which mediate the forces of electromagnetism, weak interactions, and strong interactions. And we now have a new type of particle, the Higgs boson, which is the only particle with spin zero in the standard model. And the primary role of the Higgs boson is to, well, it has several roles, but among other things, it gives mass to the point-like elementary particles. So when we say mass here, of course, we mean something very different from the mass of ordinary matter that we are used to. Matter has mass density. You can make matter denser and denser and denser, and it weighs more. And if you double the volume, you get twice the mass. But of course, the highest mass of ordinary matter is the density of a neutron star. And even though we can't be sure that the elementary particles are really point-like, the limits we have on their spatial extension is already such that the density of an electron, for instance, would be orders of magnitude higher than the mass density of a neutron star. So mass, really, of point-like particles is a different concept from mass of ordinary matter. The Higgs mechanism, by the way, also has almost no relevance for the mass of the stars and things we see in the universe. That's due to chiral symmetry breaking, but it does give mass to these elementary particles, and in particular, it makes the weak gauge bosons heavy, and therefore the weak interactions very short distance, which is an important phenomenon, of course, that we see. And I will have more to say about the Higgs mechanism a little bit later. Now, the Higgs boson is also a boson, so in some sense it is a particle that mediates a new force. We can have particles exchanging, for instance, photons or gluons, mediating the weak or strong interactions. Similarly, we can have particles exchanging a Higgs boson, and that mediates some new type of force. But that force is fundamentally different, because all the gauge bosons decouple proportional to some charges, electric charges or color charges or hyper or weak charges. And these charges are more or less the same for all standard model particles. Sometimes they are zero, but if they're not zero, they're plus minus one, four thirds, two thirds, 1/6, okay? More or less order one numbers, which means that, for instance, the electromagnetic interaction between all types of fermions are more or less equally strong, and likewise for the weak interactions and the strong interactions. The Higgs is very different. The Higgs couples proportional to the mass of the particles that it interacts with. So in some sense, it mediates a force which doesn't go like the product of charges divided by R squared. It goes like the product of masses divided by R squared. And then, of course, since the Higgs is heavy, it's also a screened force. It's a short distance interaction. And the masses of ordinary particles, I mean all the stuff we see in the visible universe is up and down quarks and electrons, these have tiny masses on the scale of weak physics, so this is an extremely weak force for ordinary matter. It becomes a stronger force when we think of the heavy particles in the standard model, namely the W and C bosons and the top quark. Those are the only ones that couple reasonably strongly to the Higgs bosons. So in some sense, this actually is closer to gravitational interactions than to gauge interactions. Gravitational interactions coupling to the energy particles or the stress energy tensor. Okay, so in this sense, the Higgs is really a new type of elementary particle, one that we have not seen before. And of course, it comes with a lot of theoretical question marks to it, as I will address in the later part of my talk. Now, the fact that the Higgs has these strange couplings proportional to masses of particles, which, by the way, is already beautifully confirmed experimentally. I will show you an electronic version of this plot later. But this is on a log-log scale, the Higgs coupling versus particle mass. Standard model predicts a straight line. We have measured the couplings for taus, b's, w's, c's, and tops, and they all lie on this line to better than one sigma. So this is an amazing plot already. And it's an amazing property of this new force that it has this funny behavior. Well, okay, so.
There are actually two lines here, one for the fermion and one for the boson.
Okay, so let me just define the Higgs coupling to be the square root of what you would define the Higgs coupling. Okay. I drew it this way because I'm going to show you the plot in this form. You're right. Yes. So, what I wanted to say is that because of this behavior, the Higgs production proceeds in sort of funny ways, and Higgs decays also have a very strange pattern. And this is the first time I'm going to use the display, because I'm going to show you a couple of plots now, which are too complicated for me to put them on the blackboard. This you have already seen. This is the fancier version of the cartoon I made there. This is the Higgs production. It's ironical, actually. I told you the Higgs particle couples proportional to mass. Nevertheless, we produce the Higgs at the LHC by colliding massless gluons, and we observe it, and we have discovered it by its decay into massless photons, both of which, of course, is only due to the wonders of quantum mechanics, namely that we can create virtual particles, and virtual particles, very heavy virtual particles, which are short-lived, can then couple to the Higgs boson. So this is the four production mechanisms of the Higgs boson at the LHC. There is the so-called gluon-gluon fusion, where you take two gluons from the colliding protons, you make a virtual top-antitop pairs, which then annihilate to a Higgs boson, and the Higgs here couples not to the gluons directly, that would vanish, but it couples to the top quark with a large interaction strength, because the top is the heaviest fermion in the standard model. There's a similar process where you just cut open this loop, and you produce a TT-bar pair in association with the Higgs. So this is called the TT-bar Higgs associated production. And I put them in the same box here because they both involve the Higgs couplings to top quarks. The other heavy particles in the standard model are the W and C bosons. So we can produce the Higgs of those W and C bosons. For instance, we can take a quark, two quark pairs from the colliding protons. They emit a weak gauge bosons, and these two weak bosons fuse to make the Higgs boson. So this is called the vector boson fusion channel. And then there's the associated production, where we take a QQ bar, we make a W or a C, and this emits a Higgs in a Bremsstrahlung type process, and we produce the Higgs in association with an electroweak gauge boson. And I put these two in the same box because they both involve the Higgs coupling to W and C. So it's important to separate these two categories if you think in terms of possible new physics contributions, right? This is one class. This is another class of production channels. And experimentally, they start to separate these two now. Gets even stranger in the Higgs D. So this is at the 7 TeV LHC, how these rates look like. By far, the dominant production channel is gluon-gluon fusion, more than an order of magnitude larger than all other decay channels. Then we have Higgs production in association with a QQ bar pair, Higgs production association with a W or a C, and then finally Higgs in association with a TT bar pair, you can see is more than two orders of magnitude down from the dominant production channel. And at higher energy, this graph looks rather similar. Things get even more strange when we look at the Higgs decays. This is a wild plot, really crazy lines there for the branching fractions of the Higgs as a function of mass. Of course, we know now where the mass is. I nevertheless show you this plot. It illustrates that the Higgs decays into whatever is the heaviest particle that is allowed by kinematics. So for a light Higgs, this is BB bar, followed by tau tau, about an order of magnitude lower, and then lighter fermions even stronger suppressed. As you go up in mass, at some point the WW channel opens up, namely here, and the Higgs basically 100% of the time decays to WW. Even higher mass, the CC channel and the top channel would open up. However, you see importantly that even at the observed Higgs mass of 125, WW is the second most important decay mode, and CC is also an important decay mode, the reason being that you can produce one of these bosons off-shell, again, as a virtual state, which then further decays. So you produce an on-shell W, an off-shell W, which then goes to, say, lepton neutrino or quarks. And that is, of course, always allowed, right? And then the closer you get to threshold, the more important these channels are. Now, the discovery channel was Higgs to gamma-gamma, which has a branching fraction of a few per mil. However, it has a fantastically clean signature because you see two photons. You can reconstruct two photons. You combine their invariant mass, and it peaks at the mass of the Higgs. And that's really a candle, if you wish, that is easy. Well, that is relatively easy or possible to dig out from the background. The CC has a larger branching fraction, but once you let the C decay to four leptons, each C decaying to two leptons. This is the channel where this was reconstructed. If you multiply that probability, you also go down to here to the per mil level. Okay, so it was very rare decays that have been used for the Higgs discovery because they are the cleanest in terms of reconstruction and in terms of sort of background suppression. Now, you also see from this plot that the actual value of the Higgs mass is in some sense a gift of nature. If the Higgs was much lighter, we could basically just measure its coupling to B quarks and tau leptons, so fermions. If it would be much heavier, we could only measure its couplings to W and C bosons. This is sort of the range where all possible decay modes become accessible. And we have already seen the Higgs going to BB bar, tau tau, gamma gamma, CC, WW. These events are very beautiful. This is the Higgs to gamma gamma candidate event. This is the textbook plots for how a discovery of a particle should look like in particle physics, namely a bump on some distribution, in this case the diphoton invariant mass distribution. If the resolution of the LHC detectors would be infinite, you would really just see a delta function here. It would not even be one bin, the width of the actual Higgs signal. So the Gaussian spread that we see here, here's the background subtracted, is due to detector resolution. And of course, in the media, you always hear funny things like, you know, physicists looked for the Higgs for a long time, and then one day in early summer of 2012, they found it, and they put it in a box, and you can see in the museum. This is, of course, not the way it works. This is a painful statistical process. This is a nice animation of as a function of date for how the peak came up in the CC to 4 lepton channel. And, you know, here it is, the Higgs signal, but you wouldn't know at that time because it's still in the noise, and then slowly over time the signal becomes more significant. And you can start preparing your preprints, and at some point you decide that is enough and you go and publish. By now, the combined significance for the Higgs discovery in all channels is some, I forgot, is more than 10 sigma. Basically, there is no chance that this signal is not real. Going to talk a little bit about the Higgs mechanism now and what we know about the Higgs boson. So this is the Higgs mechanism in the standard model. Of course, in the standard model, we break the gauge symmetry SU2 left cos U1 hypercharge, that's the electroweak gauge symmetry, by spontaneous symmetry breaking down to the U1 symmetry of electromagnetism. We have to do that by spontaneous symmetry breaking in order to preserve the Ward identities of the theory, keep the standard model renormalizable. It's not easy to break a gauge symmetry. Normally, that totally screws up the theory. If we do it spontaneously, it doesn't. Okay? So we start out with a scalar doublet here. Phi. That has 4 degrees of freedom. Because it's a doublet of two complex scalar fields. After electroweak symmetry breaking, this field picks up a vacuum expectation value, which by a choice of gauge, you can orient in a certain direction so that it enters here in the lower component. And this V is non-zero, non-zero expectation value of the Higgs field that penetrates all of space-time. Okay, so everywhere in space, this is really like the good old ether that was so ugly when it came to electromagnetism. But the Higgs is an ether. I mean, it's everywhere in space, and it's a background field. It can vibrate. The vibrations are called Higgs bosons. It's really this ugly stuff that probably shouldn't be there, but somehow is there. There is 3 of these 4 degrees of freedoms are eaten in the sense that they become the longitudinal polarization states of the W and C bosons. So the W and C acquire mass in the Higgs mechanism. And as massive spin 1 fields, they have 3 physical polarization states, not 2. And the 3rd degree of freedom is provided by 3 of the scalar degrees of freedom. And then there is 1 physical scalar field, which we call the Higgs, which is a neutral state with spin 0 and parity plus. Okay? Now, in some sense, this is a parametrization of electroweak symmetry breaking, because importantly, the structure of the Higgs potential is not explained. Not explained in a dynamical way, and this is probably the biggest weakness of the standard model. You just have to write down a potential by hand, and moreover, under radiative corrections, this potential is not stable. Okay, but nevertheless, here it is. Simple potential for the scalar field, of course, is a quadratic and a quartic term at the renormalizable level. And the crucial point is that you want the quadratic term here to come with a negative coefficient and the potential term to come with a positive coefficient. That gives rise to the famous Mexican head potential, where as a function of the field value, you get minima at values away from zero, and the point of zero field value is unstable, is a maximum, a local maximum. And of course, this potential is more complicated. It's not even the Mexican head. It's actually a five-dimensional Mexican head because we have 4 degrees of freedom, 4 different field components. So this is the absolute value, and then I shouldn't draw it to negative on the negative side. This is the absolute value of the Higgs doublet, which is a four-component field. But I think you all know what is meant here. And then, of course, the field will pick a minimum along this potential, and it will sort of oscillate about this stable equilibrium value. And in unitary gauge, where only this one component here is kept as a physical degree of freedom, we basically have to replace in this potential the field by 1 over root 2, 0, and then V plus the physical Higgs field, which is a function of space and time. Okay? And now you insert this in the potential, and after a little bit of algebra, one finds that this is equal to mh squared over 2 times h squared plus lambda mu squared times h cubed plus lambda over 4 times h to the 4, where mh square is given by twice mu square, the funny factor of 2 there that comes out from the minimization. And moreover, the value of the minimum v square is given by mu over lambda. So basically, we have two parameters in this potential, mu square and lambda. Mu square determines the Higgs mass, and the ratio mu square over lambda determines the vacuum expectation value. Actually, we knew this number from before because the Fermi constant Gf over root 2 is 1 over 2 v square. So from the size of weak interactions, we knew the value of the Higgs vacuum expectation value, which is 246 GeV. We didn't know the parameter mu at all because we didn't know the Higgs mass. Now we know the Higgs mass. And so nowadays, we know the values of these two parameters. And funnily enough, mu turns out to be 88.8 GeV. What else could it be? Lambda is not so exciting. Lambda is approximately 0.13. Is this a big or a small coupling? If you take alpha lambda, which is lambda square over 4 pi, this is approximately 1 over 741, which is a very weak coupling. It's weaker than electromagnetism by a factor of 5 or so. So the Higgs sector is weakly coupled. Mu has a funny numerical value, but other than that, we have determined the last parameter of the standard model, if you wish. This was the one parameter in the standard model that we did not know. Now, what's the experimental status of the Higgs after 1 year, roughly 1 year after its discovery? We actually know a lot about the Higgs boson already. In particular, we know its mass already with exquisite precision. The reason is that it's much easier to measure an electroweak particle's mass than to measure a quark mass, because quarks don't exist. Higgses do exist. And since the Higgs decays to gamma-gamma and the resolution of the electromagnetic calorimeters are very good, we can basically measure from the gamma-gamma or the CC modes the Higgs mass very accurately. And two experiments find very similar values, 125.5 GeV from ATLAS and 125.8, and I forgot the uncertainty, it's 0.6 in both cases, from CMS. And this is, as I said, from gamma gamma and CC to 4 leptons. Those are the cleanest channels. And this is better than 0.5%. Even not combining the uncertainties or doing anything fancy, this is already better than 0.5%. So it's quite remarkable. One can study the spin parity assignments of the Higgs bosons. Top mass, depending on who you ask, 173 plus or minus 1.2 GeV, so it's also sub-percent. Gets uglier for the lighter quarks. So for the B quark or charm quark, the errors are much larger. The top is relatively simple because it doesn't hadronize, and because its mass is so large, the uncertainties there are set by the QCD scale. Here, basically, the uncertainties are only set by the precision of the calorimeters and the detectors. Now, what about the spin parity? People have tested the hypothesis of spin 0, 1, and 2. Spin 1 is excluded by the very fact that Higgs decays to gamma-gamma by the Landau-Young theorem. Higgs cannot have spin 1. It could have spin 2. It's not easy to write down consistent quantum field theories for spin 2 particles. If you write down sort of a gravitational-like couplings of the Higgs, then this is also excluded with pretty high significance. And the spin sort of hypothesis of the pseudoscalar is strongly disfavored. And I think by now it's by about 2 sigma. I don't know the exact value, but it's about 2 sigma. People do this by looking at the decays Higgs to CC going to 4 leptons. If you measure the angular distributions of the 4 leptons, you can define 5 angles. So there's lots of observables there. 3 of these angles are very sensitive to the decay kinematics. And if you just, you know, test the hypothesis spin 0 plus versus spin 0 minus, then there's a very strong preference for 0 minus. If you ask the question, could it be 0 plus with a small admixture of 0 minus, then of course the bounds get much weaker. But I mean, if you just give one or the other option, then it's almost definitely 0 plus. So, then I come again, I will show a few plots now. I come to the what we know about the couplings, both in the sort of production and decay, various decay channels that I mentioned earlier. And also there, we have quite some information by now. These plots, of course, are famous, and you have all seen them. This is sort of the cross-section time-branching fraction for various final states in Higgs decays, normalized to the standard model value. So on this plot, 1 would mean that the particle behaves exactly like the standard model. We see the coupling to BB bar, tau tau, gamma gamma, CC in 4 leptons, and WW. And you see, for instance, in this plot by CMS, that all of these couplings are aligned with the standard model within one standard deviation. In the case of ATLAS, here and there you see maybe 1.5 standard deviation departures, but these are just perfectly compatible with statistical fluctuations. If you toss 10 random numbers, this is how a distribution would look like. Note also that when ATLAS is a little bit high, CMS is a little bit low. When CMS is a little bit high, ATLAS is a little bit low. So if you average the two experiments, you even get closer aligned to one. So this thing really, from its couplings, amazingly looks like a standard model Higgs. Recently now, these measurements become more refined because these are more complicated plots. where people now not only look at the different decays that I just mentioned, they also tag them depending on whether the Higgs is produced in one of these two production boxes that I mentioned earlier. So here we have the gluon-gluon fusion plus the TT by H channel, which is a very tiny contribution. But those are the two production modes where the Higgs couples to the top quark in the standard model. Whereas here we have the vector boson fusion and associated production with the WNC. These are the production modes where the Higgs comes from the electroweak gauge boson. And now you get contours in this plane for the various measurements, 6 to gamma gamma, CC, WW, tau tau, the different colors. And then on top of that, they show 1 and 2 sigma ellipses, so the plot is very messy. The main message is here's the standard model. And obviously, you see that that is right in the center of these distributions, right? I mean, the absolute maximum you get in ATLAS is sort of a not even a 1.5 sigma in the gamma gamma. We already know that this is a little bit off, but it's you know, within 2 sigma. And in the case of CMS, here's the standard model, and it's within 1 sigma for all the measurements. So this is already more information that also tells us that in the production, things seem to be rather standard model-like. And finally, this is the branching fraction for Higgs decays to invisible stuff, stuff that we don't see. In the standard model, that can happen. That would be Higgs decays to neutrinos. They are, of course, incredibly, incredibly, incredibly suppressed. So we will never see them. So basically, this branching fraction in the standard model is expected to be essentially zero. So that is here. And that's plotted here against sort of the strength of the gluon-gluon fusion rate. So the standard model actually, sorry, is this yellow point. Standard model, fusion cross-section, and no invisible width. This is the best fit result in this particular case from a CMS study. ATLAS has a similar limit. At 1 and 2 sigma, you can still go out in this plane. So this is not a very tight measurement yet, but you see that sort of the best fit is no invisible branching fraction and the production rate within 1 sigma of the standard model. If you assume that the Higgs production is standard model-like, then you can derive some stronger bounds because it's sort of a one-dimensional fit then where you project onto that line. And depending on who does that, they get different values in the range of, let's say, 15 to 50%.
I mean, I have a really dumb question. How do you know from the collider how it was produced?
Oh, you mean in the previous, for my previous thing, you have to tag. So, I mean, here you would have to tag the extra top quarks. I don't think that has been seen so far. Here you have to tag the extra electroweak gauge bosons. So basically, you have to reconstruct the, right? So if the Higgs is produced in association with a C boson, you have to also reconstruct that C boson. But that's why this is more challenging. Okay, so here basically I wanted to say, this is still early on in this measurement, and there is room for surprises, of course. This could easily still be 20% or 25%, but at least it doesn't cry out for some crazy non-standard model physics. Also, the invisible width at the moment looks compatible with existing measurements. Now, this is amazing, of course, that all of this looks standard model-like. The question is it also unexpected? And probably not, because we had very good hints for the existence of a light Higgs boson from electroweak position tests. This is the last plot, and then I will switch off the projector again. This is the famous blue band plot. So this is from the lab era, where basically you measure electroweak position observables, and you probe their sensitivity via radiative corrections to the Higgs mass. This is the chi-square distribution. The most likely Higgs mass would have been slightly above 90 GeV. The direct exclusion limit at lab was 114 GeV. So this is the yellow area. So looking at this plot, obviously, you expect the Higgs to be somewhere here. You know, this is 1 sigma or so, is nothing. It's a 1 sigma fluctuation, and that puts you at 120 GeV or so, and bang on, this is where the Higgs was discovered. This is another way of plotting the same information. This is the Peskin-Takeuchi ST parameters. And this is another measurement of electric position physics, and this is basically where we are now with the standard model value of the Higgs and top masses right in the center of the ellipse, basically. And if the Higgs was heavier, you would walk out in this direction. For instance, for a 1 TeV Higgs, you would be all the way out here. You could still speculate, well, maybe there's some other new physics that conspires and puts me back into the ellipse, but sort of the most natural resolution is that you're not out here, that you're right in the center of the ellipse, and that puts you again at the light Higgs. So, as I said, we had very good reasons to believe that the Higgs should be light. On the other hand, we have several strong hints that new physics, if it exists, should live at scales of about a TeV or larger. The best hint probably is from flavor physics. You know, flavor physics was not very much considered by model builders for a long time, until it was realized that if you're not very careful, you can easily, you know, you take a generic new physics model, you do a generic assumption about X couplings, you calculate a flavor change in neutral current, and you're excluded by several orders of magnitude. Flavor physics probes in the kaon sector scales up to 100 TeV if you don't impose a very constrained structure on the flavor violating interactions. So flavor physics certainly doesn't like new physics to be very light. Of course, by now we know that the LHC has not yet discovered new particles. That also, of course, doesn't play in favor of very light new physics. And finally, also the electroweak position measurements that I just showed you. For instance, if you have light new physics, it's very easy to destroy the agreement of the C to BB bar couplings with their experimental values, or the T parameter with its experimental values. Now, of course, people found ways around that. You can always add more structure to your model to stay consistent with the data, but of course you can also say, well, maybe the absence of very large new physics effect tells us that the new physics is not so close. So let's assume that the new physics scale is, let's say, a TeV. Then we can analyze new physics effects in the Higgs sector by means of an effective Lagrangian analysis, right? Because that new physics then is inaccessible at the scale of electroweak interactions. And of course, there are models that are exceptions to that, but I won't comment on that now. I will just, for the moment, I will assume the new physics, lambda new physics, is, let's say, about 1 TeV. Or even larger. Then I can analyze Higgs decays by means of an effective Lagrangian. And that's a perfectly valid description. And I can construct basically operators of dimension 6, so higher dimensional operators that can modify all my measurements in the Higgs sector. So let me just give you a few examples of such operators. They're all lambda square new physics suppressed because the higher dimensional operators, I can have a Higgs times G mu nu A, G mu nu A. This is an operator that obviously contains two gluons, and I can pull, sorry, this is really the full phi field. This is phi dagger phi. I can pull out a Higgs from here into gluons, so I can modify my gluon fusion cross section. I can write down the corresponding operator with an electroweak gauge field. So, for instance, B mu nu, this will modify my Higgs to gamma gamma decay rate. I can write down operators such as 1 over lambda squared, phi dagger, a covariant derivative acting on phi times fermion gamma mu fermion that can modify the Higgs fermion coupling, etc. Right, basically, obviously, there's a large number of possibilities. In total, there is 59 such dimension 6 operators. They were classified by Buchmüller and Wheeler in 1986, and I think they had two operators too many because they overlooked some equation of motion constraint. There was a paper by Kratzowski, Misha Groschek, and others, 2010, which pointed out that you can reduce it to 59 operators. There are 59 operators, okay? So it is well known now. Obviously, as you see here, the relative size of these operators, the relative contribution is v square over lambda nu physics square, which is of order, which is at most of order a few percent if the nu physics is at the TeV scale. If the nu physics is even higher, you can make this as small as you wish. Right? So basically, it's not a surprise that we haven't seen huge effects. It's still an important piece of information, of course. Now, if you entertain the possibility that nu physics could be strongly coupled, then these operators do not necessarily have to be loop suppressed. And then you might argue that Higgs channels, which in the standard model are loop suppressed, perhaps give the best opportunity for seeing some nu physics effects. Right? If the nu physics is also loop suppressed, you don't win. But there are some models where the nu physics might be strongly coupled. And then things like Higgs to gamma-gamma, which is a loop process in the standard model, maybe gets an enhanced nu physics tree-level kind of contribution. So that's why these loop processes are particularly interesting to look at. So there is a whole program, of course, measuring these various Higgs couplings more and more accurately, in order to indirectly search for physics beyond the standard model. I want to say one caveat here. This is sort of a desperate situation where you have 59 operators, and that's why people write papers where they say, well, you know, I have a basis that is better than your basis, and in my basis I have a reason to believe that only 8 of these operators are important and we can neglect the others. And that's often based on things like operators with field strengths are smaller than operators with covariant derivatives and things like that. It's sort of an obvious statement that a field strength is a commutator of 2 derivatives, so that statement doesn't make much sense. There were lots of papers recently in the literature fighting with each other. I mean, this is really the no free lunch theorem, right? This is the basis, and everything you do beyond that is an assumption, is a model assumption. And one should be very careful with these model assumptions. Of course, you need at least 59 very good measurements to determine all these coefficients. I think that will probably never happen, or at least not in my lifetime. But okay, maybe we can determine some of them. So I now wish to come back to, I will erase the blackboard if there are questions. I'm happy to take some questions at this point. Otherwise, I wanted to point out a few highlights of our program. I will show you, I will show you what Michael Peskin thinks about it. I don't have a plot from NEMA. Marcella says if NEMA blows his nose, they will use it as a tablecloth. But I don't know if that is true, and I don't know what NEMA thinks, but Michael has a dedicated study, and I will show you the plot. Yeah?
Yeah, I heard early on that there might be more than one hit. What happened to that?
Of course. Will come. I was so far. I will talk. I was talking about the standard model Higgs, of course. So I want to come to our program. I think it's fair to say that the Higgs discovery was such a huge event that really much of the activity in the community, certainly in the particle physics community, is very much centered on the question of Higgs and electroweak symmetry breaking, and that's also true in our program. So basically, I have 7 topics here, which all circle around the Higgs boson. Determination and parametrization of Higgs couplings, I have already talked about it, that uses this notion of effective operators. Michael Trott gave a nice seminar on his recent work on this on May 15, and I won't say any more on that. New physics effects on Higgs production and decays. We had several talks on this. Nathaniel Greig actually talked in great detail about the 2x doublet model, pointing out that, you can just assume the Higgs sector is extended to a 2x doublet model. You can also assume that you are in the decoupling limit of, for instance, a supersymmetric extension of the standard model, where essentially most of the new physics particles are heavy, and then you are left with a 2x doublet Higgs sector. So there are some additional light scalars, maybe, that one can study and that one could discover. Actually, later this week, on June 6th, on Thursday, Martin Bauer and Petro Schwaller, who's there, they will talk on new physics effects in Higgs physics in models with extra vector-like leptons, amongst other things. So that is a seminar that I advertise here and invite you to attend it. Let me just make a few comments on this point, too. Because one has to really be careful here. What one measures experimentally are these mu parameters for Higgs basically going into some final state. And these are sort of the cross-section for Higgs production times the branching ratio. And the branching ratio, of course, is Higgs going to a particular final state divided by the total Higgs to anything decay rate. And then the mu parameters are this divided by sort of the standard model values of all these quantities. Now, it's important that the observable here is a product of three quantities, and each one of those can be affected by new physics. If you see an anomaly in Higgs to gamma-gamma, for instance, you would tend to think that, well, the Higgs couples differently to two photons. But it might also be that the total rate for Higgs decays has changed. For instance, if the Higgs couples to some particles of a hidden sector and decays a significant fraction of the time to things which are beyond the standard model. It could also be that the production cross-section is changed, and that here we have to distinguish, is the production via the top coupling or the coupling to W and C bosons. So one has to be careful, in particular, because of the strange pattern of branching fractions, the total rate in the standard model is dominated by the BB bar channel. So if you have new physics which either modifies the BB bar coupling or which adds an invisible component here, that will affect all Higgs branching fractions, but it will affect all of them in the same way. So obviously, if you have several measurements taking ratios of these type of observables, you can divide out the total width, and you can also divide out the production cross-sections if you take ratios of things that are produced in the same way, and then you have access to what we're really interested in, namely these individual couplings. And it's important that, actually, I promised you the Michael Peskin plot. It's important that as we measure these observables more precisely, Higgs production and decay may provide indirect access to new physics at scales which are beyond those that can be reached by direct production at the LHC. I take the liberty here to give you an example from one of my own recent papers with three graduate students. Two of them are in the room, Christiane and Raul. Here we looked at Higgs production in the custodial and the minimal Rendl-Sundrom model. And here's the scale of the lightest Kaluza-Klein gluon as a measure of the new physics scale in this model. This is the Higgs production cross-section normalized by its standard model value. And the three colored bands are refer to different values of the scale of the Yukawa couplings of the model. And you see that you get very large effects here, especially if the Yukawa couplings are sort of large. You can easily get factors of two or more enhancements. And in this custodial model, where you have even more fermionic degrees of freedom running in the loop, these enhancements can get absolutely humongous. So even with a 10 TeV new physics scale, you can get factors of three enhancements in the cross-section, which obviously we don't see. So there is already very non-trivial exclusion regions. Unfortunately, there is a light blue band here, which you don't see. This is a pity. This is the 2-sigma exclusion. There is a 1-sigma exclusion that goes up to here. There are other reasons why people prefer largish type of Yukawas, because otherwise you run into flavor problems. So for these largish Yukawa couplings, you already exclude in this model Kaluza-Klein masses up to 12 TeV or something. Okay? So these are non. I just want to make the point. This is only one example, but these are non-trivial constraints that you can learn from loop processes in the Higgs sector. So that's why it's so important to make these measurements more precise, because it's really a new class of precision indirect constraints on the standard model. This is Michael's estimate for how one can measure the various Higgs couplings, including the invisible widths, at the LHC with ultimate luminosity, and then at different versions of linear colliders. And of course, you know, Michael made this plot, so I'm sure if an LHC person would make this plot, these lines would be a little bit smaller and the others would be a little bit larger. But roughly speaking, I think there's sort of consensus on this. And you see that, especially at the linear collider, one could get all these couplings at the few percent level and the invisible widths, which is so important, at the level of 1% or better. But also the LHC in particular, this does not yet include the upgrade that was just decided a few days ago to 3,000 inverse rectifiers. The LHC will actually do probably better than the first stage linear collider here. And this is how one will measure. This is the plot I sketched over there in the future. Basically, everything here will be a point. We will also have access to muons, which is an extremely light fermion. And the only thing that still has an error bar is the Higgs coupling to Higgs itself. So that's the lambda. The Higgs self interaction, which of course, in order to see that, you have to have, you know, the trilinear and quartic self interactions of the Higgs boson, which are extremely difficult to measure. Sorry, someone had a.
Okay, now you removed the W and Z predictions were only for values of the coupling.
Yeah, I know, and I don't know why. I don't think it matters really. For the invisible widths is clear because, you know, they just define it to be positive. Probably this means that there are some couplings where in principle you can only measure the magnitude and not the sign, and then probably he plotted the absolute value of the coupling. In some cases, by interference, you can measure the absolute value. Okay, so point three, models of electric symmetry breaking addressing the hierarchy problem. That is, of course, the main issue. I wanted to talk about the hierarchy problem, and I will not have time, which is a pity. But of course, it is a very important point to find ways of dynamically generating in a satisfactory way the Higgs potential and also keep it stable, which is non-trivial because this mu parameter is a relevant coupling in the standard model Lagrangian, not protected by a symmetry. So normally, you can't keep that stable. So this is why one of the main motivations for extensions of the standard model. We had talks on SUSY models, composite Higgs models, vector-like extensions of the standard model. Other models include partial compositeness or Rendle-Sundrum model or Higgs as a pseudonumber Goldstone bosons, natural SUSY models. Many, many possibilities. Marcella will give a, maybe, Marcella will give a lunch seminar in July, hopefully, which will be devoted to this particular point. Now, new physics, very exciting. You also have to be able to calculate in the standard model very accurately. You have to be able to calculate cross sections at the LHC, which is a huge field and an art in itself. Peter Skans gave a beautiful seminar on improving these calculations by clever resummation and matching to parton shower techniques. So that was a talk on May 23rd. Thomas Becher, in one of the coming weeks, will give a talk on how to use effective field theories to improve resummations in some of these cross-section calculations. So this is an important aspect of our program, which is disconnected from new physics. But it's important in order to search for new physics. And then I have a few things here on which I want to briefly comment. Higgs and beyond standard model flavor physics, we had a very nice lecture, in fact, the first lecture in our program by Wolfgang Altmannshofer on May 2nd, where he pointed out that quite generically, if you extend the Higgs sector by some new physics operators as I was describing them, you are bound to get flavor-changing interactions. This is very easy to see. Let's take the Yukawa sector. So some Yukawa couplings, yij, ui left, phi Higgs field, qjr. And now let's add to this some higher dimensional operator. For instance, an operator containing an additional Higgs doublet, phi dega phi, divided by lambda nu physics squared. And now I write down the same thing again. So this is one out of many possible dimension six operators, which I can write down. Now, this operator gives rise to Higgs wave plus Higgs field in this form. This operator, because it has three Higgses, gives rise to Higgs wave plus Higgs field cubed, which is Higgs wave plus 3 times h plus higher order terms. And now there's the simple point that if you collect all the quadratic terms and you diagonalize the mass matrix, you do not diagonalize this term because of the 3 here. There's simply nothing you can do about it, which means that after you go to the mass basis, you're bound to get flavor-changing Higgs interactions. And you know, this is one out of a million of possibilities. And obviously, as he pointed out, there's very many measurements in the flavor sector, things such as B to S gamma, B to mu plus mu minus, KK bar mixing, BB bar mixing, K to pi neutrino neutrino, also some in the future US program plans, which can constrain the scale of such operators. And in some cases, the constraints, as I mentioned, reach far beyond the LHC. So this is an interesting set of possibilities. Higgs in the dark sector. Here we connect nicely to the dark matter program. We had a beautiful lecture by Aaron Pierce on May 6, basically talking about searches for dark matter at the LHC, not specifically using the Higgs, but also using the Higgs. I have to be extremely brief here, but let me just mention that the Higgs portal, which is the possibility to couple the Higgs to a scalar field S that lives in some hidden sector, is one of a few ways to connect our universe to a hidden sector by means of renormalizable interactions. Right? This is a dimension four operator. So there are very few ways of connecting the standard model to a hidden sector by means of dimension four operator. This is the additional beauty that the Higgs is so nicely shielded from light standard model particles that it is, you know, it's conceivable why we haven't seen this coupling. Even if there's a large coupling here, you first have to make a Higgs to see this effect, right? Now, if the hidden sector contains particles that are lighter than half the Higgs mass, then the Higgs can decay to particles in the Higgs sector, and that would be a contribution to what I call the invisible Higgs width. This is why this is so important to search for invisible Higgs decays, because this is a very plausible possibility. And it would be exciting if we saw these invisible Higgs decays. Of course, we wouldn't look directly into the hidden sector. That we will never, because it's hidden. But you know, we would know, for instance, something about the mass scale of particles living in the sector. So this is obviously very exciting. And then finally, Higgs and the cosmos. This connects nicely to the Cosmo program. And also there are interesting intersections. A topic which is interesting here, but it hasn't been discussed yet, is the possible role of Higgs in inflation. Some people who think that even the Higgs might take a role of the inflaton. Another aspect here which is important is the question of the stability of the electroweak vacuum. The Higgs potential receives quantum corrections a la Coleman-Weinberg, and for certain values of parameters, it is possible that at very large field values, this nice Mexican head potential gets turned down and sort of runs off to infinity. if the Higgs sits in its standard model vacuum, there is then a finite tunnel probability for it to tunnel out here, at which point the energy is unbounded from below, the vacuum becomes unstable, and the universe is doomed. Now, it happens that for the observed values of the Higgs and top quark masses, assuming there is no new physics whatsoever in the universe, which probably is not so likely, the point where this happens, where the effective quartic becomes negative, is below the Planck scale. It's way up there, it's super high energies, but it is below the Planck scale. So some people take this very seriously and say, well, this is not allowed to happen and we need to fix it. This is a hint for new physics. I am not so sure. The tunnel probability is so small that the lifetime of our universe for realistic values of the Higgs mass is 10 to the 10 times the life of the universe, and I'm not sure we really need to worry about this. But some people do worry. I should also say that the calculations of these effects are not entirely uncontroversial. There are also some lattice people, for instance, who think that maybe the situation is a little bit more complicated. Okay, I have to stop. I had a lot of interesting things to say on the hierarchy problem, which I will not, except to say maybe one thing. The hierarchy problem is tied to the notion of naturalness. People took this hierarchy problem very serious for a long time, and they still take it serious. And it's used as an argument that there must be physics at scales not so far remote from us, from the TeV scale. And I think this argument is very good, but it's not bomb-proof. There are some interesting ideas for how the hierarchy problem might be solved by some ultraviolet physics in a way that does not require new physics just around the corner. I don't think there's any really totally satisfactory proposal. Otherwise, we would all work on it. But I think one should keep this possibility a little bit in mind. In particular, if you know you try to make arguments for spending very large amounts of money to build the next or next to next generation of, we're talking about the next to next generation of colliders last week. So fortunately, we have some time to make these decisions. But it is a point that one really has to question very carefully here, that we are not led in a totally wrong direction. So I'm basically done. I want to do one more advertisement. We will have a topical conference in this workshop as well, July 8 to 12. It's called LHC, the first part of the journey. We'll have very nice speakers here giving us their view on some of these issues. And for those of you who are still around then, I would encourage you to actively participate. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Oh, you are not allowed to ask.
I'm not allowed.
But go ahead.
I'm missing something from your list. And okay. That's the possible connection of Higgs and baryogenesis.
Yeah, I would probably put this.
Cosmos.
Very good. Higgs and baryogenesis. Yeah. I probably think leptogenesis is more elegant at this point and a little less constrained, but it's true that there are some very brave people who will not give up on this idea, and one should not, right? Should
always be. Leptogenesis is true.
We will never know.
How the outcome verse seems to be is fixed by what you're going to measure at the electric scale. And that does that is sensitive.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is an important point. I'm sure there's many other important things I forgot, but this is one that should have been on the list.
You seem very optimistic about the hierarchy problem, so can you comment on the little hierarchy problem?
I'm not sure what you meant by optimistic.
Well, you're saying, I got from what you're saying that you're not surprised we didn't see new physics yet.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, okay, you asked me to comment on the little hierarchy problem. So the little hierarchy problem is the tension between the electroweak scale at a few hundred GeV and apparently the fact that the new physics is not just there, but maybe a factor, let's say, 10 higher, or maybe even two orders of magnitude higher. If we just had to accept that, that would be a fine-tuning of, let's say, of order a few percent or even a few per mil. I am convinced if we discovered new physics at the scale of, let's say, 5 TeV and no reason to explain the weak scale except that it just happens to be what it is, we would all happily go home and accept it. In the same sense that we would accept that the electron Yukawa is very small, or that the up quark is lighter than the down quark, and in all other generations it's the opposite, that certain levels in nuclear physics are degenerate to an incredible precision, absolute fine tunings. I mean, once you know it's a fact, you would probably just swallow it if it's at the percent level. If it's at the 10 to the 16 level, you would probably not swallow it. So on the little hierarchy problem, of course, if you find a very elegant model that doesn't have a little hierarchy problem, I would consider it nicer. But so far, all models I know have to live with this little hierarchy problem. On the big hierarchy problem, of course, I still believe, for instance, supersymmetry is would be the most beautiful way to solve it. I wanted to add a little bit of caution on the interpretation of quadratic divergences, but maybe we do this over coffee at some point. But quadratic divergences are not super well defined in field theory. If you define them in dimensional regularization, you talk about a pole at d equals 2, and a pole at d equals 2 is not worse than a pole at d equals 4, which we all happily subtract. So to me, really, the hierarchy problem is the quadratic sensitivity of the Higgs mass parameter to physical new physics scales, such as masses of new particles. If you take that point of view, for instance, I'm not really convinced that it is an absolute necessity to have a light top partner, because the top contribution in that viewpoint is a small contribution to the Higgs mass. Actually, this morning I found a paper by Strumia from earlier this year where they give a name to this. They call it finite, finite naturalists. I think it's a stupid name. But anyway, it's something that has been discussed in the literature time and time again, but it's not something that's very deep in our heads. We usually have this thinking, the top loop has a quadratic divergence, you somehow need to cut that off. So if you had a model where you had only the top and W, and then new physics which would somehow cancel itself, I think that model would be perfectly fine. And then the argument for having it just around the corner is not so strong anymore. And there are other models where people play with classical conformality at a very high scale, or dilatation symmetry that is spontaneously broken, or fixed points of exact renormalization flows. All of these things are, have question marks, but we just, I think, have to allow for the possibility that there could be a loophole in our usual argument that we need TeV scale new physics.
Okay, Marty, last question. Sure.
I wanted to ask Jim Carter's question.
Go ahead.
Which had to do with more than one Higgs.
Yeah. Well, again, I think we had, a full hour and a half by Nathaniel Gregg on this possibility. In some sense, he argued that this might be one of the most plausible extensions of the standard model, in the sense that, first of all, it is part of any supersymmetric extension. By consistency, you need two extuplets, but also you could imagine new physics models where some of the other particles, and I think Susie was in his head here, where you could be in the decoupling limit that you push away the other particles, and what you are left with is a couple of extra light scalar degrees of freedom. It's certainly a very well motivated, relatively simple extension of the standard model, and of course one should go and hunt for these states, no question about it. And of course then you also open the door to CP violation in the Higgs sector. You get also a pseudoscalar state which CP violating interaction, so beautiful phenomenology that you can look for. Yeah, this is all in the, this is all in this category, precision measurements of Higgs couplings, including more Higgses, if you wish.
I just have one more question. I mean, it sounds like you don't really believe hierarchy problem is a problem. I mean, then why would you work on Randolph Chandra model?
I think I said before, I spent 50 billion euros to build the 100 TeV LHC, I think one should, one should be allowed to ask the question if maybe we are fooling ourselves with the naturalness argument. I mean, we really have to make the case that, you know, if you go a factor 10 higher in energy, there's no way you can miss the new physics. Or at least people sometimes make this case. I mean, maybe you don't need such a case, but you have to be careful when you make this case that, you know, I'm actually not, I don't know many of these proposals extremely well, but I know that there are some smart people sort of going in this totally off in these totally different directions, and maybe there's some truth to it.
Okay, I think we should stop here. Thanks.
Yeah.